think that the more people who know about what happened, the better. There's just so much that went on there beyond the history of New York City.
We found a mother that had been lost, and we found a grandmother we never knew.
Labor history is not on the top end of our agenda. Most working people don't know about May Day, even though it was created in the United States. Most people have very little knowledge of, even in the Bay Area, the general strike in San Francisco.
Just goes to show you that roots are important and knowing where we come from are important.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911 was a pivotal moment in American history. Not only did it create a protocol for workplace safety, it set a precedent in the labor movement as a whole. 146 people died 100 years ago on March 25th. They were mostly poor female immigrants, some from Italy, and others from the Ukraine and Russia of Jewish ancestry. They all came to America looking for a better life, to make money to send back home to their families, and to escape religious persecution. Little is known to West Coast residents about the connection of the Triangle Fire and how it affected the working class on a national level. We will hear from Eileen Nevitt, whose paternal grandmother, Annie Spinstock, has been lauded for her heroism in saving Katie Weiner, the last person to escape the inferno. We will also hear the story of Dora Miller Maisler, the maternal grandmother of Steve Rosen, who also survived the fire and went on to become a lifelong supporter of labor rights. All this and more on this Pacifica Radio KPFA special commemorating the centennial of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911 and the Bay Area connection. I'm Sabrina Jacobs. Eileen Nevitt and Steve Rosen are both Bay Area residents with filial ties to the Triangle Fire of 1911 that occurred at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York City. They both sat down with Steve Zeltzer, labor journalist and television producer of the Labor Video Project, to tell the stories of their grandmothers, as well as to examine the significance and pertinence of this horrific event on American history. For those who do not know about the Triangle Fire, those who were affected by this event have done their best to make a difference for the rights of workers, the rights of immigrants, and the rights of women over the last 100 years. Let's listen to Steve Rosen and Eileen Nevitt explain why people are still unaware of this event, its tremendous impact on history, intertwined with their individual stories.
I think it was largely known as a major incident in New York City in their history of their fire department and the history of the city of New York, and it certainly was. I think the ramifications go much further. I think that the fact that it was immigrant women also had something to do with it. It was a subject that's brushed away. And they didn't talk about it. It was uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable to talk about a horrible incident where one of the things that everybody I've ever talked to who was there or talked to somebody who was directly there and was on the street, when they reflect and they refer to the jumping bodies, it's just something that's a horrible scene and people don't want to talk about it.
This is, for some reason, this is a bit of history that has tended to be seen as a regional issue. I have been working, trying to get a resolution through Congress, at least proposed, let alone get through Congress, in recognition of the actual day of the centennial, which is March 25th. And what's interesting was, as I approached lawmakers here in California, they're definitely, I did get some feedback, gee, this really should come out of New York. And on the one hand, that's proper because the event did happen in New York. But I keep on, you know, tooting the horn, wait a minute, but this is national. the impact was national. What was done on a federal level is national, that came directly out of this event and its aftermath.
As a small child, the story of the Triangle Fire was told at the dinner table. It was explained to me that my grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe and that they had lived and worked in New York City before coming to California. And one of the events that took place was my grandmother, Dora, my mother's mother, had been in and survived the conflagration known as the Triangle Fire in 1911. As a kid, I didn't really understand, except that it was a big fire. I was told at the time that over 100 people died. To a small child, that was pretty scary. And it was always told, the story was always told with a sense of sadness that there had been this loss of life, and that she had worked in these surroundings which were unsafe. That was how I first learned about it.
This story really lay dormant until about 2008, and I actually Googled my grandmother, and lo and behold, I got two hits. And it turned out that one of those hits was the Cornell University Kiel Triangle Fire Archive. My cousin Stephen dug a little bit deeper, and we found this incredible article about my grandmother from the New York Times, written 2 days after the fire, which describes her having done this very heroic deed of actually saving one of her friends. What we found out only about 8 months ago from Michael Hirsch, who is the researcher in New York who has uncovered the identity of the six victims that were only recently identified by him, was that my grandmother was actually on the ninth floor of the factory. When the New York Times indicated she was on the eighth floor, that she was not an examiner, as depicted in the New York Times, but a sewing machine operator, and that the person that she saved was Katie Weiner. The significance of Katie Weiner is that she was the last person out of the inferno.
Die Märten grünen, gefinst mich dort nicht, mein Schatz. Wo Lebenswelken bei mir schienen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Nicht such mich, wo die Vögel singen, gefinst mich tot, nicht mein Schatz. Aschklaff bin ich, wo Ketten klingen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort such mich hoch, von Tannen spritzen, gefinst mich dort nicht, mein Schatz. Wo Tränen rinnen, Zähne kritzen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz, dort der und mein Herz das triebe und mach mir süß mein Ruheplatz, mach mir süß mein Ruheplatz, mach mir süß mein Ruheplatz.
And we just heard a lovely Yiddish tune called Mein Ruheplatz, or My Resting Place, sung by Vocalot and written sometime prior to 1910 by the Yiddish poet Morris Rosenfeld, also known as Moshe Jacob Alter. For some, it was a love song, and for others, a song expressing the struggles of immigrant workers. A very profound tune indeed. Songs like Mein Ruheplatz became popular because so many immigrant workers were forced to maintain employment under potentially dangerous work conditions, low pay, and 50 to 70 hour-long work weeks. The mostly immigrant female garment workers of New York City soon came together in 1909 when a general strike of shirtwaist workers, also known as the Uprising of the 20,000, was called by Clara Limlich of the ILGWU, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, in September. The young women were harassed, beaten, and arrested by strikebreakers and hired thugs. Public opinion was on their side, as even the bourgeois females of New York turned a sympathetic eye and offered assistance. They walked the picket lines and bailed out the strikers when they were arrested. The strike lasted until March of 1910. Next, we'll hear from Steve Rosen as he describes his grandmother as an activist with the ILGWU and a suffragist, and Eileen as she talks about the plight of gender relations and the uprising of the 20,000.
Bobby lived until approximately 96. She passed away in 1986. Bobby was a very outgoing, gregarious, warm personality, and she told me as I became a teenager about her experiences coming to this country, her experiences as an immigrant and working in the fire itself. There were other adventures she had, to be sure. She told the story that she was due to meet my grandfather. They had a date for after work that night, and that she had brought a change of dress-up clothes, which she was beginning to get ready to put on, because the fire took place just before closing. And my grandmother always teared up, and it became a display of emotion of there were so many people lost. There were such young people, and it was a pretty horrific experience. She said the pace of work was very hard. She was very productive and successful, but she said that the pace of work was very hard. She said that the place was the biggest and, for its time, the best place to be to work in that industry.
For me, the significance personally about having uncovered this story is not just the impact on my brother, my cousins, people of my generation, but more significantly on my surviving aunt and uncle, who are both in their 80s, who never had the story. You know, from my aunt, this, as her daughter described on in her comment on the blog that I wrote for PBS, she said it offers a window of understanding for her mother, a window into her mother's life that she did not previously have. So that's a very personal impact on my family. We found a mother that had been lost, a story that was told in her own words, and we found a grandmother we never knew. What I learned in school and in the more recent history relating to the suffragettes was really focused on the bourgeois upper-class women who were so important in getting the right to vote for women in 1919. Certainly for me, learning about the fact that that's one branch of the root of feminism in this country, but the other root is really these incredible women who were immigrants, who were poor immigrants, and who were fearless, just amazing women who went out, in this case, in 1909, you know, whose families were dependent on this, on their income, who may have been sending money to the old country even, and had the courage and moxie to stand up for themselves and to stand up for working women and men and to do this incredible thing of leading an uprising of 20,000 and then having the fire happen 2 years later. So I'm very, you know, one of the things that I've gotten really in touch with, that this fire has really helped me, the history of the fire, to get in touch with my cultural genome, my history, my heritage of who I am today and my generation and how much we have to owe to these women that were in the fire and in the uprising of 20,000 in 1909.
Avanti il gran partito, noi siamo dei lavoratori. Rosso un fiore in petto c'è fiorito, una fede c'è nata in cuore. Noi non siamo più nell'officina, dentro terra nei campi in mar. La plebe sempre all'opera china, senza ideale in cui sperare. Amante, dinanzi a noi glorioso va. Noi vogliamo per esso siano infrante le catene alla libertà. E la macchina sia alleata, non nemica il lavorator. Così la vita rinnovata all'uom darà pace d'amore. Più civile e giusta la storia, un'altra era sta per aprir. Largo a noi all'alta battaglia, noi corriamo per l'ideal. Via largo, noi siamo la canaglia che lotta per suo germinar.
And that was Internazionale, an Italian version of the French socialist worker song written by Eugène Pottier, a French socialist in 1871. There were no federal laws or governmental agencies protecting workers from harm, and there was no compensation when injured on the job. From these frustrations and tragedies, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, a branch of the U.S. Department of Labor, was born. Just over a year after the Triangle Shirtwaist factory workers and the factory owners settled on shorter hours and better pay, the fatal fire occurred. The owners of the factory, Isaac Harris and Max Blank, were subsequently charged with multiple counts of manslaughter and went to trial in 1911. Hundreds testified for the prosecution to no avail. They were found not guilty. Now we'll hear from Steve and Eileen again as they relay their familial stories on how the Triangle Fire and its subsequent trial were intermingled with the labor and suffragist movement in 1911. Steve Zeltzer ties in the plight of immigrant workers then to the diminishing rights of workers today.
In the transcript of the interview from the Kiel Center, she refers to being arrested three times a day. She was certainly a supporter of the union, and she was very outspoken, and they went out on strike. She herself was arrested several times, was in some scuffles and altercations, and on one occasion was cracked in the face by a New York policeman, and that resulted in the loss of some of her teeth. She talked about them not having the right to vote at the time, which to a little boy in the 1950s, I didn't get it. I just understood that we were always all able to vote, and it's only in more recent years that I've come to understand the significance of what she was talking about. Some of their first demonstrations had to do with the suffragette groups, and the right of women to vote. And there's just so much there that we take for granted now.
And maybe you can talk about the ramifications, because there was a court trial of the owners, and what
sure.
happened?
The owners, Blank and Harris, were tried in court on manslaughter charges. And the defense attorney, a man named Max Steuer, he got the owners off. He made the testimony of two crucial witnesses look like it was rehearsed and concocted. It strikes me that people who were expressing themselves in very simple English, who were not into the nuances of language and became confused by what was going on in the courtroom, were very easily addled and manipulated. And when I read the description of how the attorney went through this thing with the lock, I mean, he had it upside down, inside out, and out on Green Street in his verbal gymnastics. Even I became a bit addled and confused, and I can certainly see how somebody in the courtroom setting would have been confused. It led to their being acquitted. The owners themselves collected an amount of money from their insurance company, which they did not use to pay off families of workers. The families of the workers, some of them did get some very small amounts of money. They themselves continued to operate a business and faded from the scene over the years. There are just so many other things involved, how the press covered it at the time. The idea of labor issues were something that was regarded, I guess, as exotic. And it got coverage, but not a lot. I'd be very curious if somebody went back through the Wall Street Journal of that period and looked to see what the coverage of the Wall Street Journal was of the incident and the trial.
And, of course, the organizers of the union, ILGW, were accused of being communist. The women were accused of being communist. Yeah. And this whole – it's the communists that are creating this mm-hmm. disturbance.
Yeah, and it's a – no pun intended, a red herring. Yes, there were communists. Yes, there were infiltrators. The majority of these women and men were immensely patriotic. I mean, taking from the experience of my own family, these were people who were intensely patriotic. Not long after the fire, World War I broke out, my grandfather, who was then married and a young father, volunteered for service in the United States Army. My grandparents had my mother, who went on to become a public school teacher and taught for over 50 years in the public school system. They had a son who joined the United States Navy during World War II and served very honorably and patriotically. So the idea that these people were not patriots was dubious at best.
Are you angry or shocked that these women didn't even get compensated after being, you know, going through this nightmare, this catastrophe?
I'm not
surprised.
I, at this point in my life and my experience, I'm not surprised. I think that there was good lawyering. The credit where credit is due. I don't like the way the case went. I don't like the people that were the owners. They were. In the words of the granddaughter, who was interviewed on a TV PBS show some time ago, they were pretty despicable characters. They were certainly unsavory. But the lawyer, he did good lawyering, and he got them off, which is what he was supposed to do.
And the defense? What was happening with the defense? I mean, of the...
Of the prosecutor?
Yes.
The prosecutor, sure. The prosecutor... was in office for some time. His name was Bostwick, and I don't know much about him. There is information on the Kiel's Center Triangle Fire Archive webpage about him and also about the judge. They had been involved in other cases somewhat similar. They had been involved in labor issues and some safety things. But I don't know the details of that. I would encourage our listeners and our audience to go to the Triangle Fire website from the Kiel Center. There's great information there.
And you were able to listen to stories, you know, of,
Of
the survivors. It must be.
Right.
There are three, on the website, there are three stories. They're taped interviews done in the late 50s, early 60s of survivors. And one of them is my grandmother. And it's an eerie experience to sit there and listen to the voice of this woman that I heard over 25 years ago when she spoke some 50 years ago and was interviewed at the kitchen table of her home.
So this issue of immigrants then and immigrants today and the situation of immigrant workers, is there a relationship? Is there a relevance today?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people that are working perhaps in industries below the radar that are being exposed to all kinds of safety issues, absolutely. And not just in the United States, but across the globe. You know, as we've outsourced, I love clothes. Look at me. I mean, am I not a fashion plate? I love clothes. I'm on an advisory council for an American clothing company. I get these little emails in which I have to make comments about their products. Clothes are really big in my life. It's like, you know, Steve, you may collect antiques or, you know, other people may collect wine or art. I collect clothes to my husband's chagrin. But now I'm starting to think about where these clothes are made and who's making them. I want to make a comment that for your audience, that in case they're not aware, that in December of this past year, there was a similar kind of fire in Bangladesh, resulting in the death of many young women. It again was in a building that was not a low rise, it was a high rise, and they were locked in.
The fire and the incidents surrounding it were a pivotal point in early 20th century American history in so many ways. My own connection is that I heard these stories as a kid, grew up with an awareness of some of the issues involved. In 1980, I made a trip to New York City and tried to find the spot. It turned out I was about a block away going the wrong direction. I think that the more people who know about what happened, the better. There's just so much that went on there. Beyond the history of New York City, beyond the labor relations, there's just so much. It gets into ethnic communities. It gets into waves of immigration in America. There are so many topics that can be explored.
And these were mostly immigrant women, Italian and Jewish women?
They were mostly immigrant women. And I think that's one reason that the story has been kind of brushed aside until relatively recently.
And today in the United States, most people have no idea of this history. I mean, are you surprised or shocked?
It's been kind of interesting because as I go around telling people what I'm doing and about the events in New York and so forth and so on, I've been amazed, especially people who were raised, born and raised in New York, have some awareness of it. People in the rest of the country, certainly in the West, have less knowledge of the fire. And yet it's really such an important piece of our history. And I totally agree with Steve when he says that the different angles you can look at with this thing is amazing. Things that as Americans we take for granted. The OSHA, an idea that one should be safe in the workplace. All those things really came out of the horror of this fire, that people recognized that this was intolerable, that you could not have young people, people in general, working in places that were unsafe. And we have so much to owe from this, what came out of this event that was positive. And as Americans now, it is really important we don't take it for granted.
Well, the ILGW had been organized earlier, but it was mostly led by men. And these men were unhappy, to say the least, that women were coming to the fore. The garment women workers were a powerful force. And Clara Lemkin and her grandson actually is in the Bay Area and will be participating in some of the events, was one of the fiery revolutionary leaders of the garment women workers. And there was an effort to prevent them from having a general strike. There was an effort to prevent the women from really controlling this union. And as a result of that and this fire, the women workers began to take more and more control. So the question of democratic unions, where the women themselves were in control of the unions, was a very a great part of the struggle to protect the women workers, that it's not somebody outside, but the women workers themselves organizing and taking control of their own union and having their own union, because at that time, even having a union was a very difficult situation.
And Steve, isn't Workers United the inheritors of what of that union that no longer exists?
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, that union has merged into SEIU, actually, and is now called Workers United. And one of the important things is that there's an effort to, in the celebrations, commemorations really, to connect with immigrant women workers in the United States. In Los Angeles, they're linking up with garment workers there and trying to resuscitate the organization of garment workers, because as then and today, workers who try to organize are fired, are discriminated against. They're ripped off as far as their wages and other kind of conditions. And these are immigrant women who have trouble speaking the language, who have trouble going to court and explaining what's going on to them. So we have a real connection and relevance to immigrant workers in the United States today who are trying to survive and struggle and support their families in other countries, and also on top of what happened then, face ICE raids where they could be rounded up and then their children have no parents. They're shipped back to other countries and they're by themselves. It's a nightmare. It's a horrible situation today.
Remember, the TriangleFire.org is a national website that is bringing together the nation on this centennial commemoration, as well as LaborFest.net. You have been listening to a KPFA special commemorating the centennial of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911 and the Bay Area connection on Pacifica Radio, 94.1 FM, KPFA. I'm Sabrina Jacobs, and thank you for listening.